Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Last month, in July, voters in the Democratic Republic of Congo went to the polls and cast votes in the first free presidential election in that country in more than 40 years. The post-colonial history of Congo has been a difficult one. It was a Belgian colony for 52 years, gaining independence in 1960. In 1965, Joseph Mobutu took power in a coup. He changed the name of the country to Zaire. He ruled for 32 years. He was forced out in 1997 by a rebellion led by a man, Laurent Kabila, who changed the name of the country back to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The next year, he faced a challenge from forces backed by neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda. Others in the region joined the movement and got into the fight in support of Kabila. He was assassinated in 2001. His son, Joseph Kabila, became president, and he managed to end the fighting. In 2002, a peace was signed in South Africa. A transitional government was set up 3 years ago. That was in July of 2003. It is estimated that as a result of war, disease, and famine, almost 4 million people have died in the Democratic Republic of Congo since the late 90s. The deadliest war, it is said, since World War II. And people continue to die because there is a large part of the country that is not under the control of the government. The hope of many people has been that the elections that took place in July would mark the beginning of a period of peace and stability. And as it turns out, there now will be greater uncertainty, at least for a while, because it was just announced yesterday that the president of the country, Joseph Kabila, who was the top vote getter, did not win an outright majority. And so there will be a runoff with the number two candidate, the candidate who got the second highest amount of votes, Jean-Pierre Bemba, and that's going to take place now in October. We'll see if we can sort this out and talk a little bit about Congo and what has been going on there in recent years in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is David Potty. He is Assistant Director of the Democracy Program at the Carter Center. He's worked on election and democracy projects for the Carter Center in more than a dozen countries. He's currently managing the center's election observation project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome as we move through this first hour. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are listening can call with questions. So the only thing we ask is that people try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. But certainly, anyone's welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Potty, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Not bad, not bad.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Just to start out with, one would have to note that this election that took place in the Democratic Republic of Congo in July was apparently the biggest ever organized by the United Nations, said to be the most expensive in African history. Cost over $430 million, the tab being picked up mostly, I guess, by the international community. So obviously, many people felt that this election was extremely important, that it was important that it happened. It already had been delayed. Why obviously did so many people think that, this election was very, very important?
Well, I think there's many reasons. The most obvious context is certainly the by now very well or increasingly well-known history and tragedy of the Congo since independence, from the years of Mobutu Sese Seko through to the years of civil war, and the massive loss of life and destruction of, the country's economy and social fabric. And so bordering on nine countries, being the site of enormous mineral wealth, the Congo enjoys or has the, dubious honor of enjoying strategic interests from many, many countries, its immediate neighbors in Africa as well as further abroad from the West. And so I think that there was a confluence of all of these sets of interests on the Congo, and a lot of that is manifest in the fact that, as you say, these elections are among, if not the most expensive elections ever to have been supported by the UN and the international community in Africa.
And that has to do with the fact that it's a large country. There are transportation difficulties, simply the business of getting ballots out, getting them to places where people can vote, getting them collected, just doing all the very practical things that you have to do to hold an election. That's why it was so complicated and so expensive?
More or less, yes. The Congo runs an equivalent distance of London to Vienna, and so it's often equated to being the size of Western Europe, and with individual provinces the size of France. And so geographic scale is certainly one issue. There are, of course, many large countries in the world and larger countries that have successfully held elections under conditions of some form of duress, whether it's been, you know, geographic challenges or being a post-conflict country. But the Congo is notable for the severe absence of functioning infrastructure. There is no functioning national road network. There is no functioning railroad network. There is no safe functioning air travel or air transport network in the country. The United Nations forces operate the largest air fleet in the country, and so these are all artificial conditions in a way, because all of these support functions had to be created specifically to allow an election to take place.
There were a lot of candidates on the ballot. There were, in fact, 33 presidential candidates on this ballot. It's my understanding that a number of them, 19 of them, have all come together to complain about fraud in this election. Do you think that this election was indeed a free and fair election?
Well, the Carter Center issued a preliminary declaration on these elections on August 1st, in the days immediately following the conduct of the polls on July 30th. And it was our finding at the time of our delegation and a combination of short and long-term election observation dating back to the month of April, that the technical conduct of the polls, the immediate preparations and the actual conduct of the opening, the polling, the closing, and the counting was generally properly conducted. It was certainly a peaceful election day. The mechanics and officials of the election administration were themselves not the targets of extensive violence. There were some serious incidents, but those were of a relatively limited nature. And so to everyone's great joy and surprise, for those who were cynical or questioned the likelihood of a well-run election, the product of July 30th was a result that, or the at least the promise of a result that would credibly reflect the will of the people in their first election in more than 40 years. The tabulation process that has taken place since then has been somewhat more problematic. There have been a number of logistical and some political, but primarily logistical challenges that have affected the tabulation process. It was certainly a very lengthy tabulation process, with results only being announced yesterday, the 20th of August, from a July 30th election. That's a long time to go without results, or at least without official results. And a lot of rumor and suspicion can be generated in that time. Mm-hmm. The transport issue reared its head, particularly in the collection of the results from the individual polling locations and in their assembly at some 160 local compilation centers. And this was often a very chaotic and disorganized process that raises important questions about the integrity of the, if you want to call it, the chain of custody of those results sheets. Fortunately, the polling station results had been posted at the polling station level, and the Carter Center and other observers, other actors in the Congolese scene had certainly pushed the Election Commission to stand by its commitment to ensure that they would report the final results by polling station so that it does become possible for parties, candidates, and others who are interested to compare the published results with the posted results.
Let me introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. David Potty is Assistant Director of the Democracy Program at the Carter Center. He's worked on election and democracy projects for the center in more than a dozen countries and currently is managing the center's election observation project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're talking a bit about what has been going there on there recently, the election that took place there in July. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, the results were announced yesterday, and this, I think actually there was some indication that this is the way things were going, that the president, Joseph Kabila, he got the most votes of anyone, but didn't get an outright majority. He got 45%. Coming in there next in second place was the vice president, Jean-Pierre Bemba. He got 20%. So there will be a runoff, and that's going to take place in late October. Does this mean that on the ballot will just be the two men, just Kabila and Mr. Kabila, Mr. Bemba?
Yes. So the runoff election is between the two candidates with the greatest number of votes on the first ballot. And since no candidate received 50% plus one, the runoff will be between Joseph Kabila and Jean-Pierre Bemba.
I think that some of the analysis that I have heard suggested that some people thought that that actually if there was no outright winner in the first round, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing, or maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing if President Kabila didn't win outright. So now we have to have another election with the additional sort of expense and all the difficulties involved in it. But on the other hand, there were some people that argued that, well, maybe this might actually have avoided some potential of violence and unrest that might have been the result if Mr. Kabila did win in the first round. And I wonder what you think about that and whether you think that the fact that there's going to be another round is, you know, good, bad, or sort of not one or the other.
Yeah, it's certainly been a lively topic of debate in the Congo, and this certainly echoes more broadly among the global community of people who are involved in supporting the conduct of elections from many different walks of life, including national and international election observers. In theory and in the best of all possible worlds, an election is a peaceful exercise. It's a peacefully conducted referendum of public opinion. And at the same time, given the competitive nature of elections, they can, of course, run to be very intense competitions at that. And certainly, running an election in a country that has the path that the Congo does, under the current conditions of the Congo, with a great number of small arms freely circulating throughout the country, no effective rule of law, no functioning national institutions, and any number of adversarial militias that are organized to varying degrees, either engaged in open combat or prepared to engage in armed conflict if this process doesn't go the way they like. And so the issue of open conflict has always loomed over the Congolese transition. And in the 3 years since the Sun City Peace Accord, the conflict has been an undeniable fact of political life. It has been threaded into the transitional government structures, with representation being provided to the various former warring rebel leaders and their supporters. It has been threaded into the overall design of the electoral system, which is, for the legislative elections, is an open list proportional representation system with multiple candidates in some constituencies. So a multi-seat constituency system designed in part to try to attenuate the possibilities of a winner-take-all system. And so a great deal of effort has gone into trying to socially engineer a government of compromise, a political system that is reflective of the broad diversity of interests, many of which have been conflictual. And this, of course, it's not exactly like baking a cake. There's no hard and fast chemistry at work here. And I think that the events of the last 12 to 18 hours, in Kinshasa in particular, where there are various reports of both heavy and light arms being fired, is indicative of that balancing act that is going on. And at the moment, the stakes are quite high, particularly for the presidential result.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned this meeting 3 years ago, the process that led up to the election. I'm reviewing some stuff on Democracy Now. A couple of people were on, were very critical of the Carter Foundation. People can look at that if they want to just search for Congo on Democracy Now website and find some of this. My memory goes back to Katanga and the upheavals there quite a few years ago, and the name Etienne Tshisekedi is associated with that, and he's still around. He's with the UDPS, basically a mining area party, though quite expanded. It's one of the largest parties, and they are one of the groups that sat out because of the lead-up to this election, where he was supposed to be in the process of the election, and he was sort of just dealt out, and the U.S. ambassador chimed in support for the position of excluding Tshisekedi. With such a major factor in the election, just you can say he chose to set out the election, but he was actually ousted from the process at an earlier time. And to ignore that kind of history, I just think really belies, you know, you can look at the process of the election, the counting, and it was quiet on election day. But the fact that a major representative of a huge portion of the Congo constituencies was handled in this fashion just sort of belies the whole thing. And I think it's there's going to be a documentary tomorrow on PBS, and I'm curious how they'll regard it. I guess they're calling this Congo the first African war or something because of it, all the players involved. But I'll be looking to see how much it looks at the I realize I'm going off on a digression here, but I'll be looking to see how much it refers to the fact that all of these interventions by outside countries were funded by the resources that were being plundered. You know, it's not just the nickel in Katanga or whatever it was at the time. It's diamonds, blood diamonds. It's rare earth metals that are used to power the electronics we use here in the north. So it just seems to me that a lot of the characterization of Congo is, you know, oh, it's in the deep depths of dark Africa, and those people just don't know how to run their lives. But obviously the West and the North are very complicit in this whole enterprise, and I just think the election is not credible from the get-go, from the reasons I gave in the first part.
Well, you raise a number of points. Dr. Potty, you can respond to any or all of that if you like.
Sure. Well, certainly the fact of resource richness is indisputable in the case of the Congo. much of its long history, and particularly the history of the last 100 or so years in terms of significant contact with European powers, has been a history of that you can characterize, I think, as one of plunder and as one of disruption of pre-existing patterns of life, and one that the Congolese themselves have struggled to gain control over their own resources. An election is not necessarily a political process that answers all questions at all times in a single event. It is also not necessarily going to address many of those kinds of questions about integrity of borders, about the diversity that exists within the country and how those diverse groups relate one to the other, or the more, for non-political scientists, the more mundane questions of distribution of powers between the national state and the to-be-created provincial governments, as well as the different taxation responsibilities that are to be developed and the powers that would accrue to them. And all of this basic machinery of government needs to be created. As I said, there is no rule of law in the Congo. There are no functioning national institutions. There is not a properly functioning national police service, and there is certainly no integrity of the borders. And so by many very, very basic indicators of what constitutes sovereignty, what constitutes the basic form and shape of a nation-state, the Congo falls short in many, many of those registers. What I think that the elections do offer, however, is an immediate alternative to the current means of resolving disputes in the DRC, which has been armed conflict and disintegration of basic social patterns and the ability of the society to reproduce itself. The incredibly high death toll associated through to this more than 10 years of internal conflict through both direct and indirect deaths is a very harsh reminder of what are the secondary and tertiary effects of this kind of armed conflict. Massive displacement of people internally, disruption of their daily lives, disruption of their ability to feed themselves because they're not able to work in their fields, and an eventual breakdown of those national institutions which previously were functioning. The elections are not perfect. The elections don't answer all questions. They are perhaps the least imperfect mechanism that we have at the moment as people who want to try to resolve differences. And so I think that the fact that the international community has been so supportive of an electoral process in the Congo that process can be evaluated. It deserves to be evaluated. It deserves to be reinforced if it can be credible. The different agendas of different nation states, either longtime players in the Congo and surrounding region or some of the newer interests, that have inserted themselves into the Congo is a whole set of agenda issues that I think everyone does need to look at very, very carefully and take them seriously. But I think that the existence of uneven power relations, the existence of domination, of colonialism, of neocolonialism, should not be taken in and of itself to invalidate a process that has enjoyed a very high rate of popular participation. More than 70% of voters participated in these elections. This is a comparable number to those who participated in last year's constitutional referendum. And so I think that the...
The point I was asking about Chikasedi, maybe I said too much that raised other issues after that, so I'll ask you directly again about Chikasedi. There's an allegation that his a lot of his constituency was not allowed to register, so I assume your participation figure probably includes registered voters. So that may actually not deal with the disenfranchisement of the UDPS and Chickasaw, if you'd ask.
Yeah, no, certainly. I don't believe that there was a concerted, organized campaign to disenfranchise Tshisekedi's supporters. In fact, he had himself called on UDPS supporters to boycott the voter registration process that was undertaken in a rolling campaign last year. And he continued to call for a boycott of participation in the constitutional referendum. Towards the end of 2005, early 2006, his position was modified somewhat, and he indicated very publicly that he would seek to participate in the presidential elections. In the end, he withdrew that endorsement of the elections and the electoral process when the Electoral Commission indicated that it would not reopen the entirety of the voter registration process in order to accommodate UDPS supporters who may have heeded his previous boycott call. The rate of voter registration in the two Kasai provinces, which are understood generally to be the main source of Tshisekedi and UDPS support, are somewhat lower than those of other provinces, but not astronomically so. And so it would appear that a great number of UDPS supporters, in fact, did register as voters. And one common explanation as to why they would have done so is because the voter ID card was very highly sought after, because it is the only form of photographic identification available to most Congolese. And so it was valuable to people, if only for that, even if they were considering that they would uphold the boycott call.
I want to thank the caller for his comments. I hope he'll forgive me for jumping in here. We're past our midpoint. I want to introduce again the guest and invite some others into the program. We're talking with Dr. David Potty. He is Assistant Director of the Democracy Program at the Carter Center. He's currently managing the center's election observation project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He has also worked on election and democracy projects for the center in more than a dozen countries. Back in 2004, he completed election projects in Indonesia and Mozambique. He is born in Canada, holds PhD in political science from York University in Toronto. He lived in South Africa for almost 7 years, where he completed research for his dissertation on housing for the poor. He was also faculty member at Rhodes University in 1999, joining the Electoral Institute of Southern Africa, a non-governmental organization based in Johannesburg, where he became the head of research. And we're talking about the recent elections and recent events in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, given what has happened in the voting so far, and given the fact that Joseph Kabila won as many votes as he did and was the number one vote getter, would it be reasonable to assume that he, in the runoff, will win? Or does that open to question?
Well, I think, you know, it's, well, you know, I would probably be foolish to say it's that anything is for certain. But I think that Kabila's close to 45% level of support in the first round it certainly is indicative of a significant amount of support in the country. In most countries, 45% is more than enough to win the presidency. And the fact that the Congolese system, though, is a majority presidential electoral system requires this runoff. It's the with those numbers, it is, I think, hard to imagine that even an anybody but Kabila campaign would result in a Bemba victory. That's certainly statistically possible. It's not entirely clear that will be possible in terms of anything resembling normal election campaigning. The fact that has to be addressed is whether or not this upcoming campaign period between these two contenders will reveal itself to be a match backed up by arms. And there certainly are very serious and reasonable grounds to be very much concerned about the level of violence that could accommodate or could accompany the election campaign for a second round. Hmm.
Back at the beginning, I gave this extremely brief sketch of recent history in Congo, talking about the fact that Joseph Kabila's father, Laurent Kabila, had overthrown Mobutu Sese Seko, who had ruled for more than 30 years. Then he himself faced a challenge that involved some of his neighbors, and then some of the other neighbors came into the fight and for him. So here, now fighting in Congo, we had forces from Rwanda, Uganda, Angola, Namibia, Zimbabwe, all getting involved in this. And it was his, then after he was, Laurent Kabila was assassinated, his son took over. And I think at the time, a lot of people were wondering, well, this guy's really young. He hasn't run a country before. When he became president, I believe it's the case that he became the youngest head of state in the world. And a lot of people asking this question, well, you know, is this guy going to be up to the task? And in fact, that he hasn't done too terribly badly, at least he got the fighting stopped. How is it possible to give some kind of objective assessment of the job that Joseph Kabila has done?
It's a valid question, and it's a tricky question to answer. The character of the transitional government really was one of, as I said before, a political compromise with the different ministerial functions divided among the four vice presidents, each of whom came from a different political party and each of whom represented a different constituency, if you will, than Joseph Kabila. And so executive authority was itself truncated in important ways. And so it's very difficult to easily identify anything resembling a unitary government based in Kinshasa. I think that this balancing act that has gone on has certainly been driven by the character of the various vice presidents and Kabila. It has been tempered in various moments by the existence of an appointed National Assembly. But this National Assembly, certainly in the eyes of many Congolese, its primary characteristic has been one of foot-dragging. The preparation of a draft constitution to go to referendum was itself heavily delayed. The composition of an independent electoral commission, which is comprised of representatives of some of the former warring parties who are represented in this National Assembly, in this divided executive authority. The passage of an electoral law did not take place until late February, early March of this year. And so the calendar of the transition has frequently been held hostage to this, the negotiating and the balancing and the jockeying for a pride of position. Etienne Tshisekedi has, although he did not run as a presidential candidate, was certainly a player in all of that. He has been a vocal advocate for rejection of many of the aspects of the way in which the transitional government, of which he was not a formal part, was acting and was composed, and whose interests he, at least from his point of view, he saw it serving. The fact that Joseph Kabila came into the office of the president by the fact of his father's assassination, of course, is far from a legitimate basis for becoming president of a country. And I think if only for that reason, the elections in the Congo are important. Imperfect though they may have been in many aspects, and as conflicted as the country remains, the fact is that the Congolese people could no longer be satisfied with a president who is there because he is the son of the father.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that the fighting ended after Joseph Kabila became president, and then there was finally an agreement. A peace was signed in South Africa 2002. The transitional government was set up 2003. And to what extent was the fact that the fighting ended and there was an agreement the result of some political negotiating skill on the part of Joseph Kabila, and how much was it that so many other people in Africa decided that this was something that just had to be dealt with, that it could not go on, and perhaps even the surrounding countries that were involved recognized that it couldn't go on?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly I think it is prudent to give Kabila some of the credit in terms of his basic approach to the presidency. I think he has long been very careful to acknowledge that he is, though he is the president, he is not the sole holder of executive power. That it was a divided power, that it was a power that was shared with the other vice presidents. And I think that created the possibility of conditions for compromise. It created the possibility of there being a political life available to many of the former rebel leaders. These are not professional or career politicians. These are not people necessarily trained in law, though some of them are. These are former warring parties who are looking to transform themselves into civilian authority. And I think that Kabila has played a role in helping to keep the Congo on that course. Certainly, the fact of significant international interest, both in the region and further abroad, also played a role. South Africa has been a very important interlocutor in the continued transition since the Sun City Accords, as have many of the other neighboring countries. Some of those neighboring countries, of course, have demonstrated their support over time by sending in armed forces. That does not always sit so well, of course, with those who are sitting on the opposite side of the table in Kinshasa, from whether they are the forces that went in support of Kabila, notably Zimbabwe, which had been a very strong supporter of the elder Kabila, Laurent Kabila. But the fact that the presidents of Uganda and Rwanda and their militaries to this point have, relatively speaking, stayed out of Congolese affairs during this immediate electoral period, I think is also it's important to recognize that compared to the previous level of military engagement and incursions across the Congolese border for various reasons associated with as much with the internal politics of Uganda and Rwanda as anything that was going on in the Congo, they have stayed on the sidelines to allow this political process to unfold in a relatively peaceful way.
We have about 10 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580. Again, our guest, David Potty. He is Assistant Director of Democracy Program at the Carter Center. He's worked on election and democracy projects for the center in more than a dozen countries, and currently he's managing the center's election observation project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Telephone calls here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As an earlier caller pointed out, the country has considerable natural resources, and it seems that really in all of the post-colonial period a good part of what people have been fighting over has been control of those resources. So the question suggests itself, is it possible that the country's resources can be fairly developed and the proceeds from developing those resources fairly shared among the various people of the Congo?
It's a fair question. It's, you know, I think that the single greatest challenge that the new Congolese government is going to face will be precisely focused on gaining more control over how their resources are being exploited, and by whom, and to what ends. That's both an information gathering exercise as well as an institution building exercise. There are a great many contracts and concessions that are in effect in the DRC at the moment, with a great many foreign interests involved in those contracts and concessions. And the information is not necessarily widely known, nor is it being centrally collected and regulated by anything resembling public policy. As a result, that resource exploitation is not subject to a proper customs regime or taxation. And so the resources are being exploited, taken out of the country. Some Congolese, for whatever the reasons of their involvement in that extraction, may be benefiting, but certainly not in anything resembling a coherent or sustained manner. And the wealth that is generated by the exploitation of those resources is not being captured by the state. There is not a properly functioning state to capture it in the first place, but certainly the creation of those kinds of mechanisms and exercise of public policy are going to be among the most important challenges for the Congo to get down to the business of governing.
You know, someone once famously said here in the United States that all politics is local, and it seems that certainly that applies to the Congo, at least in the sense that you have individuals who have regional power bases, that in fact the president is very strong in the eastern part of the country and got most of the votes there. The vice president, or one of the vice presidents, Jean-Pierre Bemba, the man who got the second highest number of votes, is very strong in the west. And certainly it is very large and is a very diverse country. How does one approach the idea, or do you even approach the idea, of trying to encourage people to think in national terms, in a positive sort of sense, to develop a sense that they are a Congolese as opposed to whatever their identification with their group might be or their region might be?
Yeah, the issue of Congolese identity, Congolese national identity, is one that has preoccupied Congolese and those who have been Congophiles from abroad, who have studied the Congo and become very impassioned about the country. Of course, the pride in that can be articulated around a notion of a single national identity can be a very powerful motivating force, just as easily as it can be used in other more divisive and destructive ways in terms of identifying who is a beneficiary of that identity and who is not. The question of Congolese identity has figured in the presidential election with as a regular refrain of questions being raised about whether or not Joseph Kabila is himself a true Congolese. This is really, though, just the most prominent example of an issue that runs throughout the country, and is manifest in the different bases of political party support and candidate support, as you've pointed out. I don't think that having differing geographic or regional bases of support is necessarily a deal breaker. Certainly, in American politics, the shorthand of red states and blue states would lead one to conclude that it is possible with a very divided set of geographic political loyalties to still have a functioning national government, functioning state governments, even if one may or may not agree with the direction of the politics in all of those places. The defining feature or distinguishing feature, of course, is that we do not have at the moment in the United States a war among the states or a war of states against the federal government. Those are very real possibilities in a future Congo. Fragmentation along regional lines with breakaway provincial governments or breakaway militias that remain more or less intact despite the efforts of the United Nations to support a demobilization and integration campaign to create a national armed forces of the Congo. There are real risks still to be associated with those processes. And I think that the absence of any single functioning national party in the DRC, that too has, there's pluses and minuses to be associated with that. People remember very much the one-party state created by Mobutu Sese Seko and the way in which the unitary party, in fact, divided the people of the Congo, bound them to Mobutu and his machinery, but divided them one from the other.
We have talked about the fact that, or I did mention that in this civil war that took place, say, beginning in the late 90s, that as a direct result of fighting and also disease and famine, that millions of people have died roughly over the last decade or so, and that there was a substantial kind of peace in 2002, but that does not mean that the country is completely at peace and that there continue to be serious problems in the eastern part of the country. There continued involvement of outside forces, rebels from Uganda, Rwanda, still operating in the eastern part of the country. What exactly is the situation there?
Certainly, the perhaps the most generous characterization of the Congolese borders, particularly in the east, could be to say that they are permeable. There is no recognizable respected international border that you can associate with most of the Congo. And so as a result, people and goods and trade and, of course, arms and the holders of those arms are, relatively speaking, free to cross the border at will. That kind of instability, that kind of fluidity has certainly been a serious focus for the UN peacekeepers. They have in recent months were increasingly concentrated in the east, where most of the militia or intra-militia fighting had taken place. There are, of course, ongoing problems within the Congolese armed forces, extensive reports of human rights violations by all bearers of arms, including, unfortunately, some of the UN peacekeepers on various occasions. And so the country, particularly in the east, remains very much a country with parts of it, at any rate, at war. I don't think that it is possible to say that all of the Congo is at peace. And it certainly is not possible for all Congolese to enjoy basic human rights, such as freedom of mobility or freedom of assembly and expression. There are many hundreds of thousands of people in the Congo who are not free to go home and are not free to express their preferences or loyalties and act on those loyalties in anything resembling a polity that is at peace with itself.
So now there'll be a runoff October 29th, Joseph Kabila and Jean-Pierre Bemba. When do things gear up to get that election, to make that election happen? What sort of effort is involved there?
The effort is ongoing, nonstop. A couple of prior things have to happen. Firstly, the electoral authorities have to finish compiling the results of the National Legislative Assembly. Those elections took place on July 30th, along with the first round presidential elections. Secondly, there is an immediate period of complaints and petitions regarding the presidential results. There's a three-day period. It's a very limited window for any complaints to be registered and filed with the Supreme Court, which then has 7 days to respond. So that brings us only, though, to the end of August. The provincial elections for the provincial assemblies will also be taking place on the same day as the second round presidential. And so the candidate nomination process for those provincial elections took place earlier this year. The ballot papers still have to be printed. They are very complicated given the open list proportional representation system that exists in the Congo. And the country faces all of the same challenges of distribution of materials, training of officials, payment of election officials, and the political parties face all of the same challenges of identifying the most effective means to campaign. There is no regulation of political finance in the DRC, and this is a most imperfect set of arrangements. So there's a lot of money that floats around, a lot of use of goods, and whether it's food, T-shirts, other kinds of benefits.
Forgive me for jumping in on you there. I just must, because we're here at the end of the time. We don't have to leave it at that. I want to thank you very much, our guest David Potty. He is Assistant Director of the Democracy Program at the Carter Center. Thank you for giving us your time today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.